This is the Dreamers Podcast, where dreamers share their stories to inspire you. Now, join host Joe Pardo as he interviews a dreamer who's living their dreams.
Hey Dreamers, I'm Joe Pardo, and today I'm talking with James Stewart, who is making his dreams come true by directing and producing films. Glad to have you on the show, James.
It's great to be here.
Why don't we get started by giving some background about yourself?
Okay, well, I'm a producer, director, writer. I'm in Toronto, Canada, and I've been doing filmmaking for over a decade. Very excited. We just finished our film Foxed. That is a short film. It's coming out on iTunes on the 14th of October.
Yeah, it's really exciting. That's actually how I stumbled upon you on Twitter. And I seen that there was a short Vine from the film. And I was like, oh, wow, this looks really creepy. And I got to check this out. And then I was like, hey, you know what? There's a director. I'm going to send him a message.
That was great. I'm amazed at how wonderful social media is. I had 100 Twitter followers, then I had 1,000. Now I have a huge Twitter following just from going out to film festivals with the film, and we have a big following. And yeah, that Vine, I just looked at it today. It has like 10,000 cycles. I was amazed. It's gone crazy in like the last day.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing what you can get out of 6 seconds worth of film.
Yeah, well, especially if it's funny or entertaining.
So what does filmmaking mean to you?
Well, I've always loved filmmaking. I've always even loved photography. I guess when I was growing up, I was always looking at the world through the lens of a camera. And I was always framing things. And I just always enjoyed that point of view. And so for me, filmmaking is the motion version of that. And it's a great way to tell stories and to share stories with people. Fortunately, it's become an easier and easier way to tell stories. You can now shoot it with your phone, or you can shoot it with a crew, or small crew, big crew, and you can get it online and you can share it with people. It's really the world of filmmaking has changed dramatically in the last decade.
You know, I think that's great that you seem to want to embrace that idea, where a lot of people would say, oh no, technology made it too easy. Now everybody's a director, everybody's a photographer, everybody's a fill in the blank.
Well, it's true. That's a big challenge. I mean, part of me loves the fact that as a director, I can take a camera and go shoot something. I mean, typically we use a crew and a cameraman and lighting and actors and all that kind of thing, but you can go and shoot something, a Vine, you can go shoot YouTube videos. I think that's great. But the other side of that is, we make, I think, really great work, and something like our film Fox is stop motion. So it's shot frame by frame, meticulously shot about 3 seconds a day, with a ton of work, an original score, and an incredible cast, and I think great writing and great production value. And so we send it to film festivals. But because it's so easy to make a film now, these festivals get 5,000 submissions. So getting through the volume is unbelievable. And I think I don't know how we did it, but it's really daunting for filmmakers to try to get into Sundance. It used to be the big place to launch your indie film. Well, they get 3,000 feature films submitted, and they accept 100. So, I wouldn't want to be on the jury. I wouldn't want to have to sit through even 30 films to pick a couple. Must drive them crazy. So the good news is it's easier to be a filmmaker and make films now. But the bad news is everyone's doing it. So you just got to be better than everyone else.
Yeah, you got to find that special sauce, huh?
Yeah, that's right. Hopefully it's not cat videos.
So what would you say inspires you?
I think life lessons inspire me. I think trying to tell stories for people who are unheard, I think inspires me. So I've always tried to tell stories that I think are not being told by other people. So whether it's a personal story or whether it's a story from somebody I've met, I've always tried to tell dramatic stories that bring a perspective to a subject that the audience, I think, hasn't seen or heard before.
So you were saying that you were growing up loving photography. And so what catalyst and at what point did you decide, hey, I want to take this to the next level and I want to start pursuing filmmaking?
Good question. I think when I was growing up, I was always into art. So as a child, like as a toddler, I was always painting and finger painting and creating crafts and things, that kids do. And then I think when I was in public school and high school, I took up photography. And so I spent a lot of time. I didn't actually make films when I was a kid, but I spent a lot of time. I always had a camera with me. I was always shooting a little 110 camera, and I would shoot pictures and get them developed. And I was always collecting photographs and doing things like that. And I think that gave me my point of view because I spent a lot of time looking through the lens of a camera. Then after high school, I did not know I wanted to be a filmmaker. I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I did what all my friends were doing, which was I went to university. I took general arts degree, but I did take some film courses and some film history courses and some film production courses. And then I gradually sort of fell in love with the idea that I could actually tell stories on film. And then I took a lot of film history courses. So I learned about the classics and, you know, all the great filmmakers and how they were doing it. And then when I got to university, I just kind of started at the bottom, which pretty well everyone does. You know, I got a job as a production assistant and was sweeping floors and meeting people and working on anything I could, music videos and commercials and, you know, anything I could work on for money or no money. And then eventually worked as an editor and then assistant director, which is sort of an organizational job, and a production manager who is, you know, does scheduling and things like that. But I always knew I was a director. I always knew that I wanted to tell my own story. So while I was actually working to make money to pay the rent, I was always writing and I was always shooting my own films and going out and, you know, finding bands I could shoot music videos for on the cheap. And I always felt like I was a director, even though I was working as an editor. And so when I got the chance to start directing, because I'd been editing, I met a lot of producers and I was constantly, you know, recutting other directors' work or directors' work and things like that. I learned a lot about storytelling and visual storytelling. And then I got the opportunity to get paid to direct something. And then I just kept doing that. So I would work as an editor and a director. So I would direct my own work that I was editing and just kind of grew from there. And then slowly the projects got bigger and bigger and bigger. And that was kind of led me into working as a commercial director. So I got a chance to direct commercials, do a lot of car commercials for companies like Toyota and people like that. And at the same time, I've always been doing my own projects. So I love the work that I do for a living, but I also I've always tried to tell my own stories on the side as sort of pet projects. So I've done some dramatic films. I slowly got into 3D, stereoscopic 3D, about 10 years ago. You know, like James Cameron, Avatar and all that. But 5 years before Avatar, I shot a digital 3D project for Toyota. And that was completely bleeding edge. You know, there was like a handful of people on the planet who were shooting digital 3D. And that got me interested in 3D, which led to doing more animation and special effects work that was stereoscopic. And I've now done about 30 stereoscopic projects. And in the middle of all that, about 5 years ago, I said to one of my friends on one of my shoots, I was doing a 3D commercial. And I said, you know, I'd love to do a film like Coraline when Coraline came out. I love that film. I love the style of it. I love the color and the animation style. And he said, well, I've been shooting stop motion. He was an assistant on my commercial, but he was a cameraman in his own right, a director of photography, and he'd been doing stop motion TV shows and commercials. And so he said, well, let's do a film. So that's how the conversation started with Fox. So we ended up shooting Fox in my studio on a very small set. We self-financed it. And I've written a feature film script for Fox. And the idea was, let's do a movie like Coraline. I thought to myself, you know, it's going to be really hard to raise money for a feature film, to do an animated feature film, because you have to compete with the big studios, Disney, DreamWorks, you know, Pixar. These are $60, $100, $150 million films. There's just no way you can pitch a project like that. So I said to him, you know what we need to do? Let's get a little bit of money together. Let's shoot a 3-minute short film teaser that stands alone as a short film with a nice story. That will get people interested in the feature film. It'll get people excited about the character, Emily, the lead character, and the idea of the foxes who've kidnapped her, which is the story of Fox. And I remember saying in a meeting, you know, we'll send it to film festivals, we'll win some awards, and that'll be an easy way to get the film financed. So what we did is we made the film, and then we started sending it to film festivals. And that's what happened. It's gotten into 80 film festivals now. It's just taken off, and people love Emily. They love the character. They love her big eyes They love the creepy foxes, find it scary and funny. And some people think it's twisted and other people just think it's funny. And everyone has a different take on it about this little story of this cute little girl who's been kidnapped by foxes and has to fight her way back and discovers the foxes have taken over. So long story short, I guess I was inspired by visual arts as a child growing up. And then I ended up evolving into someone who is able to not only make a living doing what I do, but also create my pet projects on the side. And we're really excited about Fox because it's had a lot of success.
Man, you left me with a lot to chew on there. With Foxed, you decided to do something that, well, there isn't a lot of studios doing that at this point. I mean, because I think even Coraline, was that even actual stop motion or was that CGI and stop motion?
Well, it's mostly stop motion, but some CG, yeah. You always end up doing some things because some things in stop motion you just can't film, like smoke and, you know, sparks and things that fly through the air. It's really hard to capture that. Because anything that flies through the air has to be on wires because you're doing it frame by frame. So there's always an element of cleanup that's in CG, computer generated. But for the most part, Coraline, Paranorman, the Box Trolls recently, those are all stop motion, shot frame by frame.
You know, and I don't think a lot of people really know what goes into the stop motion. I mean, I grew up, and I'm as I'm sure you did, watching, you know, Rudolph and was it Santa Claus is Coming to Town, and all that was all stop motion back in, I think, the 70s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And I mean, I grew up with a deep appreciation for the work and the patience, as I'm sure you did as well, as, you know, doing a whole project based around it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, King Kong, there's a long history in Hollywood of stop motion because there's a lot of models. There's not that much anymore, but there used to be, all the special effects in Hollywood were done with models, small models of a cityscape. So whenever you had something like King Kong, where the ape was actually animated, there was a character of the ape and he was moved in stop motion. It is really an unbelievable art form when you take a puppet or a character, and we call them puppets, and you move it and move it and move it and move it and move it frame by frame. Then you look at the footage and it has come to life. Like the expressions on their face come to life, the hand motion. It still amazes me that you look at it and you go, oh my God, I've just created life. I've just taken this character that's a doll that cannot speak, it's a puppet, but I've given her dialogue and I've given her expression and I've given her movement. And when you look at her on film, on video, it's all digital now, but when you can scroll back and forth and you can see these frames, you know, lined up next to each other, you've actually given her motion. You've given her expression. It's completely magical. It's the same as when you have, you know, even your iPhone or something and you point at a bunch of things on a table and you move them around and suddenly you play the video and they move on their own. It's really, really magical. It's kind of like when you write something and then you hear an actor read it. You just go, wow, I can't believe the words that I've created are coming out of a real human being. You know, and they become that character and they're standing in front of you and you're like, wow, I had this crazy idea in my mind and here is a real embodiment of that character. And they're real. They're talking the same words that I wrote. So I find having a puppet bring a character to life is just like an actor bringing a character to life. It's magical.
You know, I've never thought about it in that text. I mean, I'm not a writer, producer, director, or even in filmmaking. So that description of what you just said is amazing now that I'm thinking about it. And that's got to be a really special feeling, especially, you know, when you're seeing it live, them acting it out, but then, you know, the after product of like, oh wow, it's all in film and it looks phenomenal, you know, and it's my words, it's my character, it's, you know, what was in my head is now immortalized on film, or well, ones and zeros at this point, but yeah.
Well, it's the same way when you have a child that you know, oh my God, my eyes are in this child. You can't believe this child is now talking back to you in the way, you know, used to talk to other people. It's crazy, but it is really magic. And I think as an artist, we always dream of creating work that will speak to people. When you create a painting, you put up on the wall, then you kind of lose control of it. You know, everyone comes up and people look at it and they react differently. You know, someone might say, wow, that landscape is is stunningly beautiful. It reminds me of my childhood, and they project their own story on it. They have this incredible story that is embedded in that painting because of what you created. And same thing with musicians. You know, you write a song and it means something to you and you put it out there, and then people grow up with it. And for the rest of their lives, whenever they hear that song, they remember, you know, that summer at camp when they were 14 or 15. And, you know, it's just, you know, Paul McCartney wrote it and he just thought it was a silly love song, and then he puts it out there, and then, you know, people fall in love to it, and it's their song, and it means so much to them. It could be love, it could be tragedy, it could be whatever you were doing at that time. And art is very powerful that way, because the artist tells a story, but then the audience interprets that story, and they project their own interpretation on the art, which I always find it very fascinating to hear, you know, critics talk about my work. And I try to just shut up and let them say what they want to say, because it may or may not be what my intention was, but it's a very deeply personal, and people are so passionate about art, and they, oh my God, that sculpture is so incredible, the way the light hits it, and you know, the way it was created. And they're right. The artist is right, but the audience is right as well, because how you've told the story to the audience is really what it's about. You know, everybody who interprets art is right. Some people might say that's terrible, that's great. They're both right, because in their mind, they're projecting their own story on it. I forget what the question was.
No, we got so far away from it. It's quite all right. Well, the next question is, how was it all received by your family when you decided that, hey, I'm pursuing the arts in general?
You know, my parents are wonderful. They were always very supportive. They never said you should be a doctor or a lawyer. They just said, do whatever you want. They were always very supportive. And I think that's important. I think parents need to let their children do what they want. I mean, it's hard. You have to steer them away from bad things, or away from, you know, too many bad things. But my parents always just let me do what I wanted. And I think it worked out okay. I asked them how they did it, and they don't know. They just think it was lucky. I have two brothers who were very successful, and, you know, my parents don't know the secret. They just did what they did. But I think it's giving kids room to pursue their dreams is very important. Never ever criticize people for their dreams, because people dream about all kinds of things. And I think you can achieve what you want to do as long as you are focused and disciplined and work at it. I think in my case, I was allowed to do what I wanted, and I found my way. I still don't think to this day they really know what I do. They don't understand it. They're amazed that I make a living doing what I do. And, you know, I tell them sometimes when my work is on TV or something, I'll say, you know, oh, hey, watch this, or if you see it. But generally, I don't really bother them with that stuff. But when I make a film and plays at a film festival, I'll say, you know, you got to come see this. It's going to be on the big screen, in the audience. I'll do a little Q&A. And I think for me, that's the child speaking, trying to say to them, you know, come and see my work. You'll be very proud of me. And it's always funny, and I think they are very proud of me, but they always, my mom particularly, the first time she came to see one of my films was at this big film festival in Montreal. After, she said, that was just like a movie. Or it was like a real movie. I was like, yeah, it was like a movie. It was a movie. Because she couldn't relate to me. You know, people don't know. If you're not in the film business, you don't know how films are made. You think you just turn the camera on and then you turn it off and you got a movie. They don't know how you make a movie. You had no idea how you would make something like that and get it on a big screen. And, you know, with Fox has been very successful. My mom has been to a couple of film festivals. She's seen it and she's very excited about it. She doesn't like the way the mom is portrayed, but I told her it's not based on her. And my dad saw it at a festival as well. So he gets it. But then this is stop motion. It's not even live action. So then explaining to people about, you know, shooting frame by frame and animating it is very, very difficult to explain to them. But anyway, my parents have always been supportive, and I think I've been lucky in that I've been able to pursue my dreams, you know, and slowly every day we get closer to the dream, or we change the dream and chase the new one.
You know, it's really awesome that your parents were so supportive. I mean, so often kids that are into the arts don't get that kind of support. And sometimes they're better off by not getting the support, and sometimes they're not. It depends on which way, you know, they use it as fuel, or they use it as to get down on themselves and go down a lesser path than they could be, you know, could be at, or would want to be at.
I think it's true. And definitely, you know, I look at the arts kind of like athletics. You know, you kind of let your kids try everything. Try painting, try acting, try music, try photography. You know, those are kind of the general things kids get involved in the arts. You know, singing, dancing, all that stuff. And they will excel at whatever they're good at. And they will like whatever they're good at because that's easier to do because they're good at it. It's kind of like athletics. You know, you let your kids play football, baseball, hockey in Canada, you know, swimming, maybe fencing, maybe some other obscure sports, running. And I guess it's genetics to initially, I'm a really good runner. I like running because I keep winning the race. So then you become a runner, and then that might evolve into football or something that where your speed matters. And I think kids fall into that. They fall into really liking things that they're really good at and really interested at. And it's rare that you would do something you're really bad at and keep doing it. It's pretty rare that you'd say, my dream is to be an Olympic swimmer, but I can't swim and I'm a terrible swimmer and I'm allergic to water. You wouldn't really pursue it. But in the arts, people do it. People say, I want to be a stand-up comic. And they, even though they're terrible, they keep doing it. They persist and persist and persist and persist. Or I want to be an actor. Even though they never get a break, they persist. And so in a way, they go against the grain, and all the, you know, the critics and friends and family say, what are you doing? You're waiting on tables. You're 30. You know, you should go get a job. And kids say, well, I do have a job. I'm an actor. You know, I'm doing this theater off Broadway. And I'm just waiting on tables, you know, for the time being. And in the arts, people pursue things that they love, whether they're good at it or not. But they pursue things because they love it. In sports, if you're bad at something, you're probably not going to pursue it. If you are a slow runner, you're probably not going to keep pursuing sprinting. or you're not going to be a marathon runner if you have no stamina. At some point, you're just going to say, I'm better off at tennis. But in the arts, people, they can't help it. They find this passion and they just say, that's what I'm doing. I'm going to be a painter. If people don't like it, screw them. I'm going to keep painting. I'm going to prove them wrong. And then you see so many artists that have these incredible styles, like Jackson Pollock. You know, what the hell is that? You know, he's just throwing paint all over everything. People look at it and they say, that's terrible. I could do that. My kid can do that. But he's persistent and persistent and persistent, and he throws all his passion down onto the canvas. And then he holds it up and you look at it and you step back about 10 feet and you go, wow, what was this guy thinking? That's amazing. But people for probably decades thought he was a nutcase.
Well, most artists are. I mean, isn't that the insane is the process of doing it over and over and over again? And yes, what you just described.
That's right. Insane, the definition of insanity, doing something over and over and expecting a different result.
Yes.
But I think artists dump their passion onto their canvas, regardless of what canvas it is, whether it's film, painting, music. How many times have you seen a singer that's terrible, but they just keep doing it? They love it. Because it's their voice and they need to get it out. You know, I don't think marathon runners need to get it out. They do it because they're really good at it.
Well, if they're dedicated marathon. I personally run half marathons and marathons, but I'm not. I don't have the physique. I just do it because it burns a lot of calories.
But you must be pretty good at it.
At my peak, I was decent. I mean, I was doing like 8 minute miles, 9 minute miles, but you know, I wasn't doing like a 5.5 minute mile for 10 miles or anything like that.
Yeah. I'd argue that's because you have a genetic disposition to being a runner. I am the same. I was always a runner. Why? I don't know. I was a runner because I was a runner. But if you weighed 300 pounds, guess what? You're probably not a runner. It's not something that's going to interest you.
Not running, at least at first.
No, but playing chess might interest you. But if you don't have the physique for being like a swimmer, the swimmers have these incredible bodies. They're like 2/3 torso and, you know, 1/3 legs.
That's true.
You know?
That is true.
And if you don't have that torso, yeah, you're not going to be an Olympic swimmer. I'm never going to be an Olympic swimmer because I, from day one, I'll realize the guys who have that torso are way better than me. I'm tired of coming last. So I'm going to be a runner because I'm pretty good at that. I guess the analogy is artists just need to get this out. It's a wonderful thing to see.
Yeah, well, I mean, the genetics do play a big part, and not everybody can be a 6'9" basketball player. You know, it's, you're either born with that or you're not.
It's very true. I was a basketball player. Pretty soon I realized, guess what? You're going to be the guard. You just don't have the height. I was a runner. I was a sprinter. And in Ottawa, Canada, the capital, there was just a point at which I was a really good sprinter, but just the rest of the crowd just took off. There was a point. Yeah, I realized, you know what? I'm good enough to make the school team, not good enough to make the regional finals, because there's guys that are way better, and they're just predispositioned to be way better than me. But it's like swimming. It's like anything. You know, you look at the genetic makeup of a lot of athletes, and if you're tall, you can be a volleyball player and a basketball player pretty easily. If you're short, wrestling is good for you. You'd be good in wrestling. That's what happens. Anyway,
so
I don't know what that means.
Oh, well, what's anything really mean? You started to go into it about what steps you took once you decided to make Foxed, but could you go a little deeper into the steps? Like, okay, I got this idea. I got the script. We minified the script. So it's, you know, short. Where next? Where did you go? What was your first step?
Well, the first step was convincing a bunch of other people to help us out, because it's a stop motion animated film that we shot also in 3D, in stereoscopic 3D. So we needed sets built. We needed puppets designed and built. We needed wardrobe for the puppets. They need hair. There's a different person that does each one of those things. Someone builds little props that are small to scale for the size of the puppets. So we just started to gather up, you know, from our community, people we knew. Oh, she's a great. She does hair. She does makeup. You know, someone else is really good at designing puppets and designing the heads and casting them. And someone else was a really good character designer, so he drew the characters. So, you know, we just had to gather, beg and borrow and gather a lot of people who could help us with little bits of this film. And then in the end, it was shot in my studio on a small set, about the size of a kitchen table, let's say. And we only did one shot a day with one animator. So the director of photography would come in the morning and he would light the set, and then the animator would work all day. And then I'd talk to them in the morning. And then at the end of the day, I'd look at the shot and approve it. And that was great. And then the next day we'd just start over. It was very time consuming, because it is a very time consuming art form, but it didn't take a lot of people at once. Everybody kind of did their job, you know, on their own. And then it wasn't a lot of people at one time, unlike a live action movie where you could have 100 people on set at once. This was about 2 or 3 people at once.
So when you say shot, do you mean like literally just one click of the camera?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's shot frame by frame. Shot with a Canon 5D, which is a kind of a professional camera, but it's not. It's a still camera, single lens DSLR. And we shot it in 3D. 3D means you need to have two different angles on the same subject. But because when you shoot live action 3D, we would normally have two cameras and you'd roll both cameras at the same time. But in this case, it's one frame at a time. So literally, you have the puppet, you have the set, you move something else, you go click, then you move everything and you go click, and then you move everything and you go click. I'm kind of simplifying it because it's attached to a computer. So you're hitting... you know, you're hitting the space bar to take a picture, and then it's recording on the computer. It is literally the same as you doing click, click, one frame at a time, and then you move the puppet, you go click, you move it again, you go click. So in this case, we did it in 3D, stereoscopic 3D, so we had the single camera doing both angles, because it's one frame at a time. So you can do one frame, move the camera over, do a frame again, and then just reset it, and then move your puppet and do click, click on a little motion control unit that would slide it over. So it was a simpler way to shoot 3D, but also a slightly more complicated way than you would normally shoot stop motion. But yeah, very, very time consuming, but very beautiful art form. The way the puppets move, the way the characters express themselves. I think it's very unique and very different from CG animation.
So when you say you move the camera, did you have like a bracket or something that would like, you could just slide the camera back and forth? Or, because I could see that becoming a problem with the 3D if it wasn't, I mean, each picture has to be the same angle and everything, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So the way it works is in live action, you have two cameras. You have to determine the distance between the cameras because that determines how much 3D it is. So in this case, you only have one camera. So it's on a slider plate, a little motion control slider plate. So it goes click and then it goes zzz, slides over. And because we're doing miniatures, the distance between the two cameras, if you will, is only about, you know, 5 to 8 millimeters. So it slides over, takes the second picture, and then resets. So creating the equivalent of two different camera angles. In live action, you know, you might have two real cameras and the distance between them might be 5 inches, 5 to 8 inches. Or if you're shooting something that's really far away, it might be a meter, it might be, you know, really far apart. But in this case, we're shooting puppets that are 8 inches high and we're about 5 feet from them. So the distance between the two cameras in some cases is 5 millimeters, 8 millimeters, 6 millimeters. So it would be overkill to have two different cameras. And because you're shooting one frame at a time, you don't need two cameras.
Right, right. Yeah, I was just thinking, like, you might not even be able to get the cameras. They might be too far away by default just because the cameras are so big. You know, yeah. You angle them so close, it would be, might be difficult. But I think that's neat that they actually come out. You have a, like, a slider plate that'll just do all that for you, all that calculation for it. Well, not the calculation, but the movement of the camera for you, so it's consistent.
Yeah, for sure.
And a quick question about the puppets. Now, since you're only taking one photo a day, would the puppets sag or anything overnight?
No, no. So what we would do is we would, I don't know if I misspoke, but we would do one shot a day. So each shot, we would do about 15 frames per second. So each shot is maybe 3 to 4 seconds. So you would do, you know, click, move the puppet, click, move the puppet, click, you know, click, click, click. And you would do the shot. I mean, sometimes it's like 10 minutes between clicks. You'd go click and then you'd adjust the hair, the hands, the foot, if it's moving, background things are moving, you know, different expressions on different characters. And then you'd go click and then you'd move everybody a little bit more and then you go click. So, yeah, but your point exactly, very hard. If you have to go overnight, it's very hard to keep everything stationary. But they're built with steel armatures. So they have a steel skeleton that is very well made and machined and very precise. So even though you can move it the way you would, you know, any kind of puppet or marionette kind of thing, you can move it. Once you move it, it stays really firm because it has a well-made steel armature inside it. So there's a steel armature skeleton, and then there is a, in most cases, silicone or foam latex, depending on the character. And then they're put inside a mold. And then they're created in latex or silicone. And then there's hair on the main character. She has hair put on her. They're hand painted, and then she has wardrobe as well, which is miniature wardrobe. But underneath them there is a skeleton, a steel skeleton, so that when they move, they can stay stationary for a long period of time. Because what you don't want is you take a picture, and then, you know, by the time you've done the shot, it's 6 hours later, and you know, she's moved on you. That drives you crazy. But in one case, and when the film is one shot that lasts 3 days, it took 3 days to shoot it. And so, you know, we had to be very careful about the position and, okay, we can end on this position. She's not going to move. Nothing will move. Nobody touch this. You know, get some sleep. We're coming back tomorrow.
Just a question for myself. When you go to take that next picture and you move the puppet just a little bit, are you using the last picture as a frame of reference?
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Yeah, because I was gonna say, like, well, how do you compensate for overcompensation? Like, they move their arm up and you moved it, and now you're missing frames, like, you're missing movement there.
For sure. So that's the beauty of digital. It used to be when people shot on film, I never did this, but when you shot stop motion on film, you didn't know what you're getting until you processed the film a couple days later. They had to be really, really precise. In this case, you have a digital tap out of the camera, so you can look at it on a screen. You see what you're seeing through the lens. And you can also jog back and forth and look at the previous frame. So, you know, you've shot 5 frames and you're about to shoot frame 6. You can look at 1 to 5, you can scroll back and forth and see the movement. And then you can look at the frame you're about to take and go, you know, that's a good place, or that's not a good place, that is a good place. Before you take it, you've already seen it in the sequence. You can kind of scrub back and forth on it. A visual DJ.
What's been the biggest roadblock you've hit along the way with filmmaking?
I think the biggest challenge as a filmmaker is just getting things done. It's very hard to get things done. It's very hard to motivate people. It's not an art form that you can do by yourself, regardless of what I said earlier about shooting cat videos. You can get a paintbrush, and you can get a canvas, and you can sit at home in your cabin in a field, whatever, and you can paint. It doesn't take that much. Or if you're a writer, you can sit down and write. There's different kinds of motivation required to do all these art forms. But getting actors and a script and a little bit of money so you can pay some people, and that's if you're totally doing it yourself. You still have to motivate people. If you're not paying them, you need to, you know, somehow motivate them that they're going to get something out of this process that could be, you know, 10, 12 hours a day for weeks at a time if it's a movie. Getting people excited, getting people motivated, getting yourself excited, keeping your excitement going long enough to get through what is a very time-consuming process is, I think, the biggest challenge that filmmakers have. You need to be like that dog holding on to the bone. You know, once you get a hold of that bone, even though your feet are in the air, you never let go, because, you know, if you let go, no one else is going to give you the bone again. You know, you have to just be so persistent and so motivated. And, you know, you have to pick the right kinds of projects. If people don't like your project, they probably aren't going to help you. So you need to create stories that people want to hear and people are excited about, and they'll read your script. And, you know, even if he's the props person, he's going to love the script and he's going to love what he's doing, and he's going to, you know, build the best props ever. And the set designer is going to build the best set ever because they love your story and they know that you're going to have the energy to start and finish this project. So even though it's getting cheaper and cheaper to make films, the biggest challenge, I think, is getting people together and getting the energy up to actually finish the project. Starting it is easier than finishing it. And we found with Fox, because it was a very lengthy process, as you imagine, it's stop motion. We also did it on our own dime, so it took us 52 shoot days to make the film over the course of about a year. So that wasn't every day. Some days we would do 5 days, then we'd take a couple weeks off because people were busy and people went off to other jobs. So keeping that momentum going and keeping the energy level was very difficult. I had invested in the film, so there was no way we were not going to finish this film. We couldn't. Like, not finishing the film was not an option. We would take a couple weeks off and regroup, and, you know, people could go off and go on vacation and come back. And to not finish this film was just not an option. And so I think for artists generally, fulfilling your dream is it takes a lot of energy and takes a lot of determination.
What's some of the ways that you stay motivated and help keep your team motivated, especially on this project where, I mean, a year, you know, it's only 52 days out of a year. I mean, that's less than 2 months of actually seeing the people. Well, I guess just for the shoot, I'm sure you were with them after the fact.
Yeah. I think that the project motivates people. You know, I think I have a good energy. I like to do cool things and stories that people like, and I think I'm pretty generous with people. I, you know, buy them lunch or whatever and try to keep people happy. I think that, you know, people need to have fun. They need to enjoy what they're doing. And if they're enjoying what they're doing, they will help you out and they'll believe in what you're doing. You know, there always has to be something in it for them, you know. And so in the craft of filmmaking, typically when you're doing your own projects, people get to upgrade their skills. That's kind of what's in it for them. You know, they're shooting one thing, they want to shoot something else. If that something else is your project, that gives them a chance to experiment with something. You know, the composer might be doing jingles or commercials, and he gets to do a drama. Or somebody's doing a dramatic TV series and they're really good at that, but they'd love to do a feature film. So that's kind of their little upgrade. And people are motivated because everyone wants to grow as an artist, no matter what you're doing. And because it is a real collaborative art form, you have to have people who are really engaged and really excited about what you're doing. It's kind of like building a building. You know, you can't, if you're an architect, I'm the architect of the film, but I can't do it without without everybody. I need a lot of people to build this story. So, you know, in many cases you pay them, you know, in the case of a big budget film, everyone's getting paid and they're, whether excited about the story or not, they're excited about working and getting paid. If you're doing your own project and you're paying people half their rate or a bit less than their rate or nothing, you have to find other ways of tapping into their passion and getting their passion to somehow be reflected in the story that you're trying to tell, which is your passion.
Yeah, I can imagine it's got to be difficult to go through and find those people. I mean, I'm sure you to a certain extent you attract certain people because of what you do and what the project is, but you know, just because you attract 100 people doesn't mean that you want to work with all 100 people, because that's 100 different personalities and that's a lot of time you got to spend with them. Like you said, sometimes 10, 12 hours a day, you know, for weeks at a time. So it's got to be a task in and of itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's also a good test of your project. If people believe in you and believe in your project, it's probably a pretty good project. If people lose interest in your project, yeah, you know, it's kind of in a way they're judging it. You know, I'm not saying you should be defeated by every critic, but if people are kind of like, I'm too busy to do that, it's probably because they don't like the project. If they loved it, they'd make time. If they don't like it, they're like, go get someone else to do that, because I'm too busy to do that horror film. Unless it's Halloween, then they're available.
What's been the biggest disappointment so far with filmmaking?
I think the biggest disappointment that I feel, and maybe many filmmakers feel, is it's very hard to be prolific. It's very hard to make many films because it is time consuming and it takes a whole lot of energy. And, you know, you only have so many years on this planet and you only have so many films in you. You know, I think that in the end is kind of disappointing. I would love to make 100 films, 100 feature films. I'm not likely to. I might only make 10, 20 if I'm lucky. So you kind of have to pick the projects, unless you're Woody Allen, who, you know, makes a film every year and he's made 20 or 30 feature films or something like that. Most directors, you know, Quentin Tarantino's only made 6 or 7 films. He's only going to make 20 films in his life or 25 films in his entire life. Sorry, that's not even the right math. He's made about 7. He's probably won't even make 15 in his whole life. You know, if it takes you 2-3 years to make a film, a lot of directors will make under 10 in 30 years. You know, that's kind of disappointing. If you think about your own mortality and think, how many films do I have in me? You know, if you only have 15 films in you, 15 feature films in you, what are those feature films? You might not want to make a bunch of crappy films. Just to keep yourself busy.
Yeah, I think that can apply to pretty much anybody with everything. I mean, you only have so many hours, you know, to do things that you aren't sleeping, aren't eating, aren't pooping, aren't, you know, and, you know, all these other driving or working.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a painter, you can do thousands of canvases. If you're a filmmaker, you're not going to make thousands of films. I mean, I guess unless they're YouTube videos, but if you're going to make a well-told, well-acted movies, there's only so many you can do. And I think in the end, that is a little disappointing, but it is the reality. And I think it maybe that disappointment motivates me and others who are doing it to, you know, get on with it.
Yeah, definitely. So, James, you're having a dinner party and you could invite any 3 guests you would like to have at this dinner party. Who would they be?
Well, if they're living or not, I would invite Einstein, Martin Scorsese, and Steve Jobs, and mix it up with some women. Maybe Joan of Arc. She could tell us what really happened. And maybe Galileo. And I think that it would be a great conversation. I mean, Marty Scorsese talks really fast, so he would have to shut up once in a while. It would just be really great to hear, you know, great artists talk about the theories of art and the theories of the universe. And I think that putting someone like Einstein in the room with some artists would be very interesting. I mean, I think he was a big fan of artists, but he was also kind of out there in terms of, you know, his theories and the way he thought. And that's what made him a genius. And I think all those people are geniuses in their own way. And I think it would be really really great to listen to them and to ask them, you know, what they thought of the world and creativity and art and the universe and how it all mixes together.
I think you got a film right there.
Yeah. My dinner with Andre.
So could you share a favorite memory from your filmmaking?
Well, I made a film years ago called Teen, which was about a little bit, it was sort of a snapshot of life as a teenager. And it was the story about a girl who'd been molested by her father, and she was trying to hide it from her friends. And it was based on a true story, not my own personal story, but a story that a girl had told me, a girl that I met on a bus once. And I was just shocked and appalled and could not believe the story she was telling me.
On a bus? Random person?
Yeah, to strangers, exactly. I mean, it's strangers are very comforting. The anonymity is very comforting. So I made this film based on her story. I think that one of the great memories of doing that shoot, it was very low budget and self-financed, and I had a lot of great friends working together. But, you know, we'd begged and borrowed everything. We were in an old abandoned drive-in movie theater. And it was just magical. The sun was going down and we had to get this one shot. And the girl who played the central character at one point tells the kids their car is broken down in this abandoned drive-in. And she tells the kids what's happened, her friends, her three other friends. The first time we did it, we didn't rehearse it. We just shot it because we were losing the light. And I knew this was a very emotional scene for this girl actor. And I knew she could do it. I knew she had it in her. We'd rehearsed it. And I just wanted to shoot it because she could nail it in one take. And it was a really wonderful moment to hear her tell this story as an actor. And to just see that, wow, this character that I've written, this character that is on the page has now totally come to life and is this girl. And to hear every word coming out of her mouth like it was real, like it was her own. And I'd actually taken this character and created her and listened to her talk back to me. It was, I think, a really incredible moment and really touching moment. Especially because in this case, it was a very touching story. But it was just a very slow dolly move in on her. And I was looking at it on the monitor, and she was lit beautifully. She was backlit by the sun that was going down. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, she is real. Like, this is a real – she is really moving me to tears. And I wrote what she is saying. I can't believe that she is really that good. And this character has come to life so much that I'm seeing her and hearing her like for the first time. And that was a very moving moment.
Wow. that's pretty powerful stuff there, man.
Yeah. And even in Fox, we have a couple similar moments when Emily is up against this window and she's saying, Mom, Mom, can't you hear me? She's essentially saying that. And she has these big eyes and she cannot believe that she can't be heard. And that's sort of one of the themes of the films, but there's this film. And there's a moment where she's at the window and similar, very powerful moment. Well, not very different, but for Fox, it's very, very powerful.
I'm definitely excited about the film. I've pre-ordered it on iTunes, which everybody can and should. So James, what is your dreams for the future look like?
Well, my dream is to get this film made, get it on as many screens as possible. So we're going to take the little short film and we're going to parlay the popularity of the little short film into some financing for a feature film version of Fox, which is a story of all the kids in the village who get kidnapped, starring Emily, who is the lead of the short film. My dream is to get the film made and get it seen by as many people as possible. And hopefully move kids and move their parents and create a film that people really enjoy that's both popular but also has some lessons and people learn something from. That's the next step. Hopefully we'll get that done.
Yeah, you hear that? Fox, Sony, Disney, Universal, you hear that?
That's right.
That's what needs to happen.
That's right. So that's our competition.
Well, I mean, they wouldn't be producing it.
That's right. Yeah, they would. Someone would distribute it. We're going to produce the film on our own, but we need some financing and we need a distributor. So I think that if everyone downloads the film, that would be a good first step. we're not going to make a ton of money off it, but at least it'll prove that the film is a great character. And so please download it and leave your reviews. And if you like the film, say something nice. If you don't like the film, don't say anything. But it launches on the 14th of October. And or it launched on the 14th of October, depending on what day you're listening to this. In pre-sales, it's been number one on many of the iTunes stores. Number one in Indonesia, number one in Canada, number three in Germany. Don't ask me why. That's just the way things are. And hopefully it'll be popular. And if you want some more info on foxmovie.com, there is some behind the scenes, and there's some artist drawings of our characters, and there's we have a fan community, so you can send pictures. And we're showing Fox worldwide starting on the 14th in 60 countries on iTunes.
Wow. I mean, that's a huge launch.
Yeah, it's 4 minutes. And it's playing, it's subtitled into four other languages, Dutch, Spanish, French, and German. And it's in English film for the American audience. But yeah, please share it on Facebook. Please tweet about it. Hopefully we'll get to make the movie.
So before we get going, is there any last thoughts you'd like to share?
Other than begging and groveling for people to support the film? I think I just did that.
Sorry, you'll get one more chance to do that before we go.
Okay, good. No, I'm just really proud of the film. I'm very excited that that resonates with audiences. I've been to quite a few film festivals. I haven't been to all of them. I've been to maybe 10 or 15. And I never get tired of seeing the film with an audience and seeing how people react to it and doing a Q&A after a question and answer period with people telling me what they think of the film. I'm always thrilled and mesmerized by what people think the film means. So hopefully when you see the film, you'll play it a few times and think about the subtext of who the characters are and what they mean and what their story is. It's not just about a kid being kidnapped by foxes. The foxes, you know, represent a lot of struggle that every human goes through, and certainly teenagers go through. So it's hopefully motivating for kids to think about life and think about their goals and fight for what they believe in.
I mean, that's such a great message. And when I saw that message on the website, I was like, I really, really hope that James joins me on the show, because this show represents all of that. I mean, I definitely feel like I've tried to represent that all of my life. And as a kid, you know, to a teenager, to now, fight for what's right and what is right and fair. And it's just great to see that there's, you know, movies like that out there that aren't just big budget films and that are artful in the sense that, dude, you guys took like 2 months to just to take a bunch of snapshots. I mean, that takes passion and a lot of patience. So I really admire that.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's funny. Some people say it's just a film about a girl who gets kidnapped by foxes. And I say, oh, you should watch it a couple more times. It's only 4 minutes. Every time they watch it, they see something else.
You should just do an extended release. Put it like 5 times on a loop so it's like 20 minutes long.
That's right. Well, I think it has a whole new life as a vine. People are looping the vine, the 6-second vine, and they're like, oh, this is drippy.
Well, we'd love for you to plug all your websites and how people can connect with you again.
Okay. So yes, foxmovie.com is the main one. There you'll see some background on the film, the story, the actors, and you'll see artist rendering in the community section. You can see some of the things we've done from film festivals and people who have sent us pictures of themselves with posters. And you can send pictures if you see Fox, or you can take a picture of yourself watching it on your laptop or on your phone and send it to us. We'd love to put it on the website. There's also some behind the scenes footage, which I always find amazing, and people really like that. You get to see the puppets and see what they really look like when they're not acting. And yeah, I'm on Twitter, JamesStewart3D, which is JamesStewart3D on Twitter. Join us, follow us, and if you say nice things about Fox, I promise to retweet your stuff. And Fox Movie on Facebook as well. I think it's facebook.com/Foxed or Fox Movie. And we have a community there as well. Still playing about 3 or 4 film festivals a month. After iTunes, we're going to probably slow that down a bit. And we're also going on Vimeo next week. So if you're more of a Vimeo person, you can check us out on Vimeo. If you search Foxed, you'll find it. But no matter where you are in the world, if you search Foxed on iTunes, you will find a great little poster of Emily. Click on that and you'll find the movie. It's only $2.99. It's 4 minutes long. It's a short film, but it's a really big story.
Oh, well, I'll have all those links at howtodream.co so everyone can get them all and connect with you.
Great. Thank you.
Not a problem. I really hope that this works out for you in the sense of giving you that film that you're looking for and, you know, being able to connect with all these people from all around the world with your message. I mean, you know, even just doing the short film is such an accomplishment that it doesn't, you know, not that it doesn't matter if you don't get the film, but you've already had a lot of success with it. So it's not like it was wasted by any means.
Yeah, well, I think I'm living proof that if I can do it, anybody can. You know, I think if you have a dream, you can pursue it, and bit by bit, you can get there. And if people don't believe in your dream, you should get them out of your life.
I couldn't agree more. Well, James, I really hope that at some point I could bring you back on to follow up in, you know, 6 months, a year, and see how you're doing and just check up.
Sure, I'd love to. We'll come back with the movie.
Yeah, I hope so. Oh, God, I hope so. So just remember me when you're big and famous and directing like 2 films a year and doing all, you know, palling around with all kinds of big stars.
For sure. Well, you'll come on the red carpet to the Oscars with us.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Podcast from the red carpet.
Yeah. That would be phenomenal. Well, thank you again, James, for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dreamers Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Dreamers Podcast. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/Dreamers Podcast. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the Dreamers Podcast, please send an email to j@jpar.co. This podcast is copyright 2014 by jpar.co.